we want to continue moving forward with body-worn cameras, or is this something that is now, you know, given the data storage, the public records request, the prevalence of smartphones, that even my 88-year-old mother has one, I would doubt that she'd be able to actually fully get the video to function. But, you know, there was a case last week where community members were filming an officer. I just think that that's a policy question that we should take up sooner rather than later.
I had a question. What is defined in the term disorder? Does that range from domestic violence calls to public inebriation, or, I mean, how big of a catch-all is that disorder category?
Disorder is things like disturbance calls, welfare check calls. Public inebriates would be included in there normally, depending on how the call comes in. Something that doesn't start out as a report of a crime.
Is it domestic violence calls? Does that fall under disorder too?
It could, yeah.
Okay. Depending
on the outcome.
And my other question is, you know, what is the intersection of the optimum amount of overtime for an officer? I mean, officers have expectations that they're going to derive a certain portion of their income from overtime. So if we're wildly successful in our hiring goals and overtime correspondingly reduces, but, you know, what's that point below which it becomes a concern to the rank and file?
So I think that's a fair question, but it's a rather philosophical question in that depending on the audience, or, you know, if you ask me as the chief, I would say I would love to operate without overtime whatsoever. Overtime is an unfortunate need just because of we just don't have enough people and time in the day to get all the shifts that we need filled. But at the same time, it's not a right. It's a privilege, and it's not an entitlement. So I tell people, you know, don't live beyond your means if you don't have to. Hopefully you shouldn't have to. But it's not something that should be built into your budget, because at some wonderful time we can figure it all out and figure out how to work very efficiently without overtime. So I don't know if I'm the best person to answer that question, because I'm not a huge advocate of it. But I understand that it's a necessary evil.
Okay. Thanks. Here.
Commissioner Fish.
Chief, I'm looking at your ad packages, and, you know, unless there's a dramatic change in our forecast, we face the prospect of having to take some general fund cuts in other bureaus to fund ad packages in public safety. So we're going to have to obviously look very closely at the asks and make some tough choices. The budget office is recommending about a fifth of what you're requesting in your first ad package, which is adding sworn positions. And they're also recommending no new funding for your fifth ad package, which was enhancing neighborhood livability and walking beats. Now, I can tell you that we hear from a lot of people, and not just small business people, but also community members, that they would like to see our officers walk in a beat. And that's sort of like going back to the roots of community policing under Bud Clark. So you have before you what the budget office is recommending, and we have to sort this out. This is your chance to tell us what you think of the pushback on your asks, not to just single out the budget office, but there's a disagreement between your bureau and the budget office that we have to resolve as if we're going to get a balanced budget here. And second, I'd be interested to know that in the event that we had a limited amount of money to invest, whether you are you would seek to have all the money into your first ad package, or whether you would envision a scenario where we put some money into ad package one and some money into community policing.
Thank you for the opportunity to clarify. And I'm not mad at the budget office. They had a job to do. I totally get it. But I will put it out there that they work very closely with us, and we're willing to collaborate. So I appreciate that. The biggest takeaway, if nothing else, is we keep talking about community policing as if it's a thing or a line item. We need the resources in order to do the things that envelops community policing. That means we need the people to do it. So around the holidays, we committed to being highly visible in certain portions of the city. We didn't have the luxury of having people available to do it. We had to rob Peter to pay Paul to make it work. So something, it basically came at the detriment to somewhere else, meaning that we didn't provide services in a manner that we wished that we could have provided services in another part of the city in order to have higher visibility and a walking presence downtown during the holidays. That's just the reality of it. In order to be able to do that on a consistent basis, we need the officers that we're asking for. Now, when we're talking about filling the patrol districts first, that's just basic. Making sure that we can get to these calls when we're called in a timely manner. Then, from that, if we have extra, then we can bolster our walking officer capabilities. The communities that work really well with their NERT officers or service coordination teams, our behavioral health, all these things that the community praises, they all come at a cost. Those aren't officers that are assigned to regular patrol units. Those are extra. So in order to be able to continue to provide the services that we are in a humane manner, outside of just enforcement, outside of just responding to calls for service, we have to have the ability to fill those functions in those units. So it's not, I don't see it as an either or. It's critical in the sense that if we continue to funnel our efforts in the areas that the community wants, we all want it. We want to be seen. We want to provide services. We want us to see us outside of our uniforms. They want us engaged. We want to be engaged. We want to have a day where it's not murder, death, kill all day long. But it's ebbs and flows. And the ability to be able to do that means that we have to have the officers out there to be able to do it, but also provide the basic service of responding to calls, 911 calls. So that's the first part. The second part, I would say, and the reason why we emphasize this so much in our presentation, is it's about staffing. So the first package, it really addresses the bulk of our position requests. So I don't want to put myself out there and say, well, if you had to go with one, then, you know. But the priority for us truly is staffing. And if we can find other ways around the other asks that we made, we'd certainly be willing to do that because we are totally cognizant of the fact that this money all comes from the same pot. Totally understand that. But the criticality today is the ability to answer calls for service and to continue to provide the services that we've been providing and hopefully enhancing our visibility and being present in preventing crime.
So that's a very thoughtful answer. Thank you. And you've given us a lot to ponder. Can I ask a follow-up question, sort of unrelated? We keep reading in the paper that this administration wants to make an example of sanctuary cities. And it appears that the only way they can do that in the short term is to penalize cities and states that have taken that action by withholding some discretionary law enforcement grants. Have you been advised that any of the grants that you rely on to sort of fill the gaps are at risk in this budget cycle?
Would you like to talk about the cops grant, JAG
grant? Catherine Ryland, fiscal manager. We receive JAG funding.
JAG refers to?
Justice Assistance Grant. And we've received JAG money for as many years as I've been here, at least 8 years. We did apply for this year's JAG grant. We haven't been told that we're not going to receive any money, but we also haven't been told that we are going to receive money. The deadline that we've had in the past for receiving notification has come and gone. So we did have a request in our budget for funding for the LifeWorks program that our sex crime team is associated with.
And how much was they asked?
$110,000.
And if we're not successful getting that grant, does that mean you have to find those funds from existing budget?
Well, it was recommended to be funded by CBO. Thank you very much. But if we didn't get the recommendation and don't get the money, we'd have to make the decision of continuing that program or not.
I see.
And might I just add, to going back to your original question, you know, I talked about the ability to provide services and keep up with demand, but it's also doing it in the way that we're asking them to do it too. So think about it. You know, you can have all the officers that you need that are on overtime filling these districts to make sure that we get there when we need to get there. But if they're tired, if they're burnt out, if they're overworked, think about what their decision-making process would look like, right? Think about that, the message that it sends to them. And then on top of that, I'm saying, I want you to do it with a smile. So it's not just the ability to provide services. It's also ensuring that we show we value our employees and their well-being. And I just wanted to make that clear as well.
Rob?
This question is more addressed to the CBO and in regards to the body camera program. Your documentation talks about both the Rialto study and the Washington, D.C. study, and points out that the latter was more methodologically robust. I'm just wondering if those are the only two studies that are out there. I was able to find a bunch of other studies on this topic, and it seems like a little bit of cherry picking. So I'm wondering if it's your sense that there's a consensus on whether or not body cameras yield better outcomes for both the police and for the people they serve, or if we're still at a place where no such consensus exists. And then I have one more question, but it's not for you. So,
Katie Shifley, City Budget Office. I wouldn't say that there are consensus. There's a consensus right now, and even outside of sort of reductions in use of force or citizens' complaints, there's still a lot of other reasons that you might want to have a body camera program. But this is the most recent study that's the most methodologically robust, and it did sort of counter a lot of the prevailing sense, rationale for having body cameras that was out there. So you wanted to highlight that. There's still limited research on body cameras and programs in general. And actually, you know, sort of the crux of our recommendation is that should we decide as a city to move forward with this program, we should really be engaging with our academic partners and contributing to that body of research that's out there and evaluating whether or not we're sort of getting the outcomes out of this program that we expect to.
So if I could just add a little color commentary. I'm aware of the studies and the counter studies, and even the study that concluded that there really was no difference in behavior on the part of officers with or without body cams in a controlled study, their very last sentences in the study said, but you should still do it because the public feels like there is more trust, more transparency, and more accountability. So I thought that was a weird twist for a scientific study to say we have all this data and it doesn't conclude that it works, but you should still do it because the public sees it as a transparency and accountability tool. So my view on this is rather than go whole hog, because it is a very expensive proposition, is that we first communicate with a lot of different communities that have already done this, communities that have had successful rollouts like Fullerton and Anaheim, communities that have had direct experience, including the chief's former city of Oakland. And we're also deploying to some cities that have rolled it out and then pulled it back and then re-rolled it out, like Seattle, to find out what their experiences have been. I would propose that if we go forward on this, and it has been my firm belief that we should continue to go forward, we do it on a pilot basis and make sure that we are satisfied that given state statutes, which are different here in Oregon, given the technology and data management challenges that continue to exist around body cams generally, and given public input on this process, let's see where it takes us. The reality is that the data is minimalist at this point. It's really hard to draw a conclusion one way or another based on one or two studies, in my opinion. That's just my opinion.
Thank you. That's reassuring. My second question is for the chief. which is if the council were to approve or substantially approve the staffing plan that you have put forward, would that eliminate the use of retired officers being paid at the highest level on an ongoing basis, which has, I understand, been the practice for some time and is quite a pricey one?
I'm like, is she writing the answer to that over here? Yeah, thank you. I know what I would say, but I need the technical answer, and I'll follow up on what they say.
So retire, rehire came about really because of a different problem that we had, which was filling vacant positions. As long as we have the ability to fill vacant positions in a timely manner, and as long as we can somehow get out of this boom and bust of hiring cycles that we have, eventually a program like Retire Rehire wouldn't be necessary anymore. Where a program like that becomes attractive is when you have a lot of vacancies to fill all at once, because then you get the alternative of having somebody in one of those vacancies who doesn't take 18 months to train. One of the things that we're trying to get at beginning in this budget proposal is the idea that we always have a certain number of officers in that training pipeline. So at the staffing level that we're looking at for 5 years out, that would be about 75 officers in a training pool. Right now, it's 60. And there's some complicated math that someone smarter than me used to figure that number out. If we can get to the point where we pretty much always have that number of people in the hiring or in the training pipeline, then we would do away with these shocks in attrition that make something like retire, rehire attractive. Does that make sense? And so that is one of our goals over the course of this five-year plan, but that's a longer-term problem to solve because it's a 25-year cycle from when someone's hired to when they retire.
Let me just add up really quick, follow up with that. I want to remind everyone that the retire, rehire program is at the discretion of the chief of police.
Commissioner Daly.
Hi, Chief. So I remain very interested in the rationale behind our staffing levels for police. I know that certain types of crime, person and property crime, is on the rise after years of decline. And I think a cursory glance at those numbers might suggest, well, we just need more police. But for me, I need to understand the root cause of that increase in crime. How much can we simply attribute to population increase, for instance? It's just a per capita rate. How much can we attribute to worsening socioeconomic factors like growing income inequality, lack of economic opportunity, lack of affordable housing, et cetera? And I'm particularly interested in how many of these increased property crime calls are associated with auto theft, because as we know, unless we're going to stick an officer on every block to catch someone in the act of stealing a car, actually, I don't even know if that would help solve our problem at the state level. And then the third piece of that, so it's what's driving the increase, how much of it is associated with auto theft, which is kind of a unique situation for us because state law dictates that we can't arrest someone even if they're in possession of a stolen car.
It's a high threshold.
It's a high threshold because they can claim they didn't know it was stolen. It's nonsensical, but it's real. And then the third part of my question is we are gathering data, but we're not analyzing it. So we currently aren't really doing intelligence-driven, predictive policing, which I think could impact our staffing needs in a positive way if we were using our officers more efficiently. So sorry for the long-winded, winding question, but it's all very interconnected in my mind.
Actually, it is very interconnected, and I would even say socioeconomic factors have something to do with crime, whether it's increase or decrease, right? And I don't have the answer to you today as far as specifics as to what's driving it, but we do know that it exists. And I've had some great conversations with community members that share your questions. And one of the questions asked of me was, well, if we solve the livability issue, will that help decrease your crime numbers? Because we know that there are some crimes associated with the house's populations, but they're low-level crimes. And if you address that, the root cause, then the crime will go away. That's not really an issue for me as the police chief, because I have to deal with the issue right now today. So we know that we didn't get where we are today in a matter of 5 years. It took over a period of years. And I am the fire chief, actually. It's a public safety matter. We have been at the table discussing livability issues because we don't want to criminalize the house's population. But the reality is that there's still crimes occurring, and I have to deal with it. And it's not going to be solved in the next year, two, three, or even five. Right? I would like to say that it is. So what we're addressing, or what we're offering today, what we're asking for today, is to allow us to address the crime as it occurs, because we know it's not going to be resolved in a short period. This really is a short-term fix. Hopefully, in the end, all of the other socioeconomic factors that we know have a relationship to crime, whether it's education or, you know, poverty level or all of that stuff, over time that will be impacted. But again, I have to concern myself with what we're tasked to do. I wrote down the other, there was something else. Oh, predictive policing. So since I've gotten here, that's actually the direction that I've given. Strategy is huge in what we do, but it's even more important when you don't have all the resources that you need. You have to make sure that our efforts are intentional, but we also have to make sure that we're not policing in a disparate way and we're not over-policing certain populations. So even if we did have full staffing, or if we didn't have enough staffing, how we police doesn't impact the amount of officers that we need. Using predictive analytics or using all of the information that we have available to us, which is what we have been doing since I've gotten here, again, doesn't change response times. It doesn't change the number of calls for service that we get. Those are things that are outside of our control. Now, making sure that the outcomes are what we want them to be and that we're not policing in a biased way, again, that's all front-end stuff. That's how we do it. But again, it doesn't change how often people pick up the phone and call the police for services. So it's important, but they're not. One doesn't really have anything to do with the other.
Yeah, I have one more comment and one more question. I certainly appreciate you wanting to be able to address the demand that exists right now. I think our challenge really is, in a budget cut year, where will that dollar be most effective? Is it prevention? Is it in homeless services? Is it in police? And that's what I'm struggling with, and that's, you know, that's really the crux of all my questioning around the rationale for staffing levels. So my second and final question is, there's a lot of confusion about our community policing plan. Could you just in a nutshell tell us how many positions are currently being funded or will be funded, what those officers will actually do, how it will help alleviate burden on our, if they're not, whatever the opposite of community policing officers are, and when those positions will be filled? Because I think we're still in the hiring phase.
We're doing a good job with actually attracting and hiring people. But again, as it currently stands, we can only hire up to our current authorized strength. What the 93 additional, and then I'll turn it over to you two. What we're asking for are 93 additional sworn positions and 9 additional non-sworn. Of that 93, the breakdown would look like this. 81 for patrol and neighborhood response teams. 4 to enhance our training efforts, 6 to enhance the emergency management unit, and two to enhance the behavioral health unit. Those are the sworn bodies. The non-additional or the nine additional non-sworn positions would be to support their support positions, to support the emergency management unit, to support the behavioral health unit, and to enhance the capabilities of our auditing team, which is all tied into the DOJ.
Okay. And what's the current staffing level for the... Aren't there specific slots for community? No.
So I want to make sure we don't look at it as officers assigned to just do community policing, right? Mm-hmm. So because there could be a misconception or a misperception that we'd be filling specialized units first without addressing the patrol needs, and that's not the case. So first priority is to make sure that all of our districts meet minimum staffing levels in patrol. Now, once we have more officers in patrol, that generates more reports, or it could go back to the question as, or does it? And that's something we have to circle back on. It's a fair question. There's more investigative work to be done, which means there's investigators that have to have a decent workload so they can investigate these crimes and get them presented to the DA's office for charging. So it's a trickle-down mm-hmm. effect. And then, again, walking units, neighborhood response, so on and so forth. So we have the ability to add to these specialized units that are out in the community, but the basic ask is to make sure that we fill the patrol at minimum staffing first. So it's not to say that we are doing this solely to create another unit, if I'm clear on what your question is. I might not be. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Commissioner, are you also talking about community service officers? Is that part of your question?
Yeah.
Because that's, I think, part of mine is, and I asked the fire chief this, do we really need a sworn firefighter to do the community medical services? We've invested a lot of taxpayer money in the contract, which includes allowing the community service officers to come on. You know, for things like the car thefts, it seems quite reasonable that somebody who isn't a full officer would mm-hmm. be able to go take the reports and do some of the work. So could you talk a bit more about how you mentioned that in your report? But,
I did.
How could this play into the whole issue of being out in the community, being a more friendly face, doing more of the proactive work?
And I'll turn it over to Chief Davis.
Because we currently have none of them hired yet, right?
That is correct. That is correct. None hired. I think we are now, I think it's up to negotiating salary, so there is movement in that. But again, the number of CSOs, and I actually think, and I think you and I have talked about this before, past life, previous agency, we had a similar position. They were great for handling calls that had been standing for a long time, which we would refer to as a cold call or a cold report, or to be put on a perimeter post so we didn't utilize a sworn officer for long periods of time. So there's certainly a value add there. But given the slide that we showed with the increase in high priority calls, CSOs wouldn't be able to respond to those as well. And the small number, I don't think, would have a huge impact right away. But I'll let Chief Davis talk a little bit more about where we are with the CSOs.
So as the Chief said, we've been working with BHR and with Class Comp, and we've ironed out a draft of a class spec. And then the next step is to talk to PPA about that, work on, you know, salaries obviously have to be negotiated with the union, and that's one of the next steps here. At the same time, our training division is working on what the training program looks like, what kind of equipment needs that they'll have, and the goal is to have all those different lines meet at one point. The most time-consuming and difficult part of this is ironing out all of the details of a position that hasn't existed in the city before.
Okay, thank you. And then also following along from Commissioner Udaly's comments about the root causes, one of the things that we could do instead of having more police
doing more proactive time is to look at some of the other ways of outreach. And I know that in Oakland you were familiar with the ceasefire program.
Yes.
And looking at how do we actually provide services to our high impact, just like the fire bureaus looking at their high volume callers and how can they better help them. We've got some high-risk folks, and the council during the recession chose to invest in parks programs for teens in particular, which has actually proven successful in helping them have something positive to do rather than getting into trouble from being bored. So is there... I don't see that in your budget request to move more into expanding programs and services for high-risk offenders.
No, it wasn't a specific budget ask, and we haven't met yet, so I don't want to speak on it in a public session because I haven't had a chance to speak with her about it yet. But collaboration is key in a lot of this. So, yes, I'm talking about staffing, but again, it's for basic patrol services and to get the stuff done that we need on a day-to-day basis. We have had to rely upon partners in order just to get a lot of our stuff done now today. But you mentioned ceasefire, it's very successful in Oakland. A lot of prevention efforts and the decrease in recidivism that we experienced had a lot to do with collaboration with partners. And hopefully that's not a huge budget ask or requirement from us because that's funding and programs that already exist. Part of my goal of community engagement and inclusion is working with our partners, not here just at the state and federal level, but at the local level as well. And ONI would be a huge part of that.
And was the police bureau in Oakland very much involved in that ceasefire program?
Yes, we ran the ceasefire program. It was all coordinated through the police department and human services.
Be very interested in hearing more from you about that and looking at could we expand what we do here.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So I have a question about the specialty units, and I'm just reading the CBO's report here, and I'm kind of reading between the lines, but are you saying if you don't get the money from us that you need for minimum staffing for patrol that you would eliminate the traffic division?
My hope would not be to eliminate, but generally that's the first thing that we would look at would be specialized units. We can't continue at the pace that we're in, so we would have to eventually cherry pick from our specialty units, not necessarily traffic, but that would be one that we would look at.
For elimination or just reduction?
Well, we'd start with reduction.
Reduction, yeah.
But I couldn't promise that we couldn't eliminate.
Yeah, I just noted in your presentation that was one of the areas where it's going up the most, I guess, safety related around traffic issues. And I guess I've always been schooled that it's better to have officers who are specifically trained to do the driving under the influence test and all that so that they'll stand up in court and all that.
Yes.
As opposed to having it sort of every officer's responsibility, that we're not as successful in achieving our goals that way.
I agree.
I'm glad you brought that up. Could I just follow up on that question? Because we've got $500,000 in ongoing money from the cannabis tax for that kind of enforcement. But if we're talking about, and so I hope we'll have that discussion of how we're going to allocate the cannabis tax money this year. If we're talking about cutting the traffic division, I think we've got to have a hard discussion about do we continue funding the service coordination team, which City Budget Office is proposing to use $1.4 million, no more than that, nearly $2 million of cannabis tax money for the service coordination team. I have been a big supporter of that program, and I know for the individuals who it serves, it's been life-changing and in terms of getting ahead of recidivism and all those things. On the other hand, if it's that or stopping a DUIs and speeding, I think that's a discussion we need to have.
Yeah. Frida?
I'm going to ask different questions. I'm kind of a techie person, so... I'm not going to ask you that detail. I was listening to the fire chief, and they are looking at efficiencies and using technology for efficiencies. And when you come to report writing, it's a lot of it's administrative. It takes a lot of time. What is the Bureau doing in regard to trying to streamline things to make it more efficient in those aspects? It's not going to take away from having to necessarily go out to a high emergency call or anything, but it might trim some time.
No, and since that's your Bureau, I'll turn it over to you. But I do want to say that's a very good question, because we talk about 21st century policing. It's not just community engagement. That's one aspect. Technology is also a huge piece of it. Training is a huge piece of it. Officer safety and well-being is a huge piece of it. So that's also something that I hope to see us utilizing moving forward, and as a strong recommendation coming out of our strategic plan that's coming forward. But I'll let Chief Davis talk about what we're doing now.
Sure. So specific to report writing, there are a couple of things going on. We have a report writing platform right now that the contract for that is up with the vendor in 2021, I believe it is. So we're looking already at, you know, is that still going to be the best option for us at that point? We don't know. So we're looking at what other options are out there, because report writing and records management system technology has been evolving so fast. And it's still in the hypothetical phase right now, but, you know, one of the things with the body-worn camera work that we're doing is not just looking at where the state of the technology is now, but where it will be 5 years from now. If you talk to people in the body-worn camera industry, for instance, they'll tell you that they envision a day where your body-worn camera will actually help you write your report. You stop and, you know, you're at a traffic collision and you get someone's driver's license, you're able to hold it up to your body-worn camera, it reads it, and starts auto-populating your report, almost like Alexa for your police car. That's all, we call it vaporware right now. Nobody's invented that, but that's what the conversation is in that part of the world, and our profession is certainly one that will benefit in ways you and I probably can't even envision now in the fairly short term from technology, and so we're keeping our eye on things like that balanced against the typically very high cost of stuff like that. But yeah, that's a big part of the discussion.
And my other question, this more from a personal experience, is, and I know you haven't been on the job that long and you're still assessing things, is about 2 years ago we had a break-in in our shed, and I'm savvy enough, I'm not calling 911, I'm calling non-emergency. And I didn't need a police officer, truthfully. There wasn't a lot a police officer could do. But they still sent one out to take the report. Are you looking into the future? Because there's a lot more people like me that on a non-emergency thing that would be easy for me to go online and just fill out what happened and all that information. You've got your report, and no officer had to come out. Or they could assess at that time whether they felt they needed to come out. Are you heading in that direction?
We do that now. We have online reporting that's taking an increasing number of calls. You have to be careful with that, because you can have things slip through the cracks and get reported online that had you sent somebody out to ask some questions, you could have found some solvability factors. But the short answer is, yeah, we're definitely doing that.
Could I just add, you had started trying to play a 911 call at the beginning of this conversation, and it was a carjacking that was in process. How long did it take to dispatch a police officer?
Well, Mr. Mayor, the reason why we chose that call was to do exactly what you're asking. We wanted to demonstrate how long it took in order for an officer to be dispatched and arrive to take that call. We set an alarm for ourselves, because when that time was up, we were going to say, this is how much time has elapsed, and we still have 1 minute and 30 seconds left to demonstrate when the officer actually responded on scene to take the call. It took an hour and 3 minutes for the officer to be able to not only be dispatched to get there, and it was because they had to come from another part of the Southwest area because they were held up on another priority call in the area. It wasn't because they were off having coffee somewhere or just lollygagging. It was due to lack of availability. So the reason why we chose that was to demonstrate the response time issue that we're dealing with right now today.
So, and I'm sorry for jumping on your punchline, right, but that's illustrative that the time from when we were going to hear that call until a minute and a half from now is how long it took to respond to an active carjacking call. So the reason I mention it now, Frida, is a lot of the types of direct community engagement services that used to exist do not exist any longer. And as I think about the settlement agreement with the Department of Justice, as I think about the demands of the community in terms of police transparency and accountability, the farther we are away from direct interaction, the harder it is to rebuild that community trust. And it's harder for our folks to know exactly what it is the community they serve needs if they're not actually out there in the community. And so that's a great example of how we can use technology, but it's not going to replace, I don't think anytime soon, actual human-to-human interaction.
Just one last comment since you brought up that community piece. You wouldn't know, but I'm from East Portland, where the biggest population, most diverse population is, and a lot of immigrants and stuff. And I work with East Portland Action Plan and with Civic Engagement, which is our multicultural committee, you might say. And we have various people from, whether it's Latino, Russian, Arabic, you name it. And we've been very active in getting people on citizen committees and advisory committees. But we've had a couple on the police, one of their advisory committees, and they didn't stay very long. And I know, having worked in schools for many, many years in a volunteer capacity, is the making people feel welcomed. And they felt marginalized and therefore didn't stay very long. And I don't know if you have plans to work on that aspect, because it's part of getting the community involved, is also making them feel welcome and wanted and their ideas and voice respected so they can speak up.
The answer is absolutely I do. It's all part of what we're talking about. It's, again, what we want them to do. It's not only them feeling welcomed, but it's giving them the time that they need in order to stay long enough so they can feel welcomed. But again, when we're talking about trust building and relationship building, that takes time. So they have to be given the discretionary time to be able to do that.
May I have
yes, Kofi.
Question? Yeah, I have a question about staffing. How long, in average, does it take the police bureau to hire an officer from applications to offering the job before the training?
That's one of the areas where we've actually made a lot of improvements, and we've got it down. I apologize, I don't have the exact scientific average, but it's roughly 6 months right now.
6 months, okay. So before you have access to, the number of officers allowed, it will take about 2 years.
Yes.
So I want, the decision makers to keep that in mind, that before the police bureau can meet at least the minimum required officers, it will take them 2 years. And if they have to come back every year to request the number of officers, I think it will be very hard for them to meet those requirements. So I have concerns about the fewer number of positions recommended by the CBO. That's why I'm asking that question.
Yeah, that's correct, Kofi. And adding to that is the reality that demographically, a lot of police officers are retiring right now. Now, the opportunity, of course, is we can recruit young, diverse candidates with a different skill set, and that bodes well for the future. But in the meanwhile, we're certainly pinched. Very good. Any other questions before we wrap this up? Thank you, Chief. Thank you, AC Davis. Appreciate it. Next up, Bureau of Transportation. All right, good afternoon. Thank you, Director Treat, for your patience. We got a little behind schedule early this morning. Thank you for being here. Bureau of Transportation.
Great. Thank you so much, and good afternoon. So in our budget request, we have three main priorities that are reflected before you. One, we are investing in road maintenance and capital projects to repair streets that are in poor condition and build new projects that bring our infrastructure up to modern standards. Two, we have to have safe streets. The budget before you continues our commitment of eliminating roadway fatalities by 2025. And finally, in this budget, we're making the investments that will help keep Portland a livable city with a high quality of life as we're growing and changing. We are committed to supporting citywide priorities. You have made addressing the lack of affordable housing an urgent issue, and our budget reflects this in a few ways. In support of the city's affordable housing efforts, PBOT is a co-lead on the mayor's fast-track permitting pilot. We've continued to make affordable housing development a priority in all aspects of permitting, including allowing impact fees to be waived for affordable housing development and reducing UVE lease rates for affordable housing projects by 50%. Thank you. I didn't know who the wizard with the thing was. We also are supporting affordable housing through our planning and policy activities. Studies have repeatedly shown that transportation and housing costs make up the lion's share of most household budgets. So if we can lower transportation costs, we can make an indirect but a very real contribution to housing affordability. One of the key ways that we can lower transportation costs is by providing safe, convenient alternatives to incurring the cost of owning and maintaining a personal car. So this is one of the reasons that we are partnering with TriMet on the Enhanced Transit Corridors Plan. Through this plan, we're identifying where we can give priority to transit on city streets, and doing so is going to better support TriMet's frequent service network by getting buses out of congestion, making public transit more reliable and efficient. We also contribute to reduce transportation costs by expanding the infrastructure that makes walking and biking a safe alternative to personal automobile use. For example, through Gateway to Opportunity in outer northeast Portland, we will invest tens of millions of dollars to expand the area's bike network and improve the crosswalks. These investments are also going to make it easier to access transit available. As the challenge of homelessness has grown, so has PBOT's contribution to the city's response. In the coming fiscal year, we project that we're going to spend close to $4.5 million on homelessness response. We've been centrally involved in the city's efforts to clean up campsites, and the budget before you continues to fund these efforts. Due to the dramatic increases in the cost of these services over the last year, we are very supportive of OMF's request for additional general fund monies to support the immediate response cleanup efforts. If that request is approved, it could save us close to $1 million that could then be reallocated to asset management, Vision Zero, and congestion mitigation. We've also increased our efforts to respond to the presence of derelict RVs on neighborhood streets. These RVs have become one of the most visible manifestations of Portland's homeless crisis. As part of the city partnership that has responded to derelict RVs, we have taken two steps. We've hired more inspection officers to speed the ticketing and towing of abandoned RVs so they can be removed quickly from the streets. And we've worked with the Portland Police Bureau and One Point of Contact to create a community caretaking program, tow program. This program addresses the RVs that are occupied, creating a system that allowed for the removal of those vehicles that presented an immediate threat to public health and safety. Through this program, we addressed 149 cases last year. In this budget, we're requesting six positions and $1.5 million in general fund monies to continue these efforts in the coming fiscal year. Without these positions, existing staff from parking enforcement are going to continue to be devoted to RV removal instead of parking enforcement, resulting in about $1 million of lost revenue in our budget. Many of the challenges that we face as a city cannot be solved by one bureau alone. And that is why you all have rightly directed us to break down traditional silos and collaborate on citywide solutions. In the last year, we have worked together with our sister bureaus on many fronts. I've already mentioned our efforts on campsite cleanups and mitigation of RVs, But last year, we also launched Get Portland Moving. It was a regional construction coordination initiative. We partnered with city bureaus, county, state, and transit agencies. We brought a new level of coordination to construction and maintenance projects on the streets in the Central Business District and in the Cully neighborhood. And by doing this and working closely with other agencies, we estimate that we saved $5 million in cost avoidance. We've also continued our longstanding partnership with the Water Bureau and BES. PBOT surveyors provide the bulk of survey services for BES on sewer and stormwater projects, and PBOT maintenance and operation crews provide paving services to both water and BES. Also, PBOT and BES are currently in our second year of a joint leadership team initiative. The team is tasked with identifying joint funding opportunities and realizing project efficiencies through closer collaboration. This has proved especially effective on the Capital Highway Improvement Program. Due to our working closely together to provide the community a safer, more efficient street, it also is going to have state-of-the-art sewer and stormwater infrastructure. And last, in an effort to improve the overall delivery of city capital projects, staff from PBOT, BES, and Water, and the City Attorney's Office have gotten together to write, review, and update the city standard specs, which is used on all capital projects by all the bureaus. Since our participation in the Smart City Challenge, we have also worked closely with other bureaus, regional agencies, and the private sector to advance our efforts to use cutting-edge technology and data resources to modernize our infrastructure. We also want to expand service delivery and improve the customer experience. To support citywide racial equity goals and strategies, we're collaborating with the Office of Equity and Human Rights, Portland Parks and Recreation, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, Bureau of Development Services, Portland Police, Portland Housing, and BES on the completion of the action items in our bureau-specific racial equity plans. These are just a few examples of our partnerships, but we continue to look for innovative ways to work across traditional organizational lines. Each year, as we budget to most effectively maintain our assets, we face a fundamental challenge. Our infrastructure is deteriorating faster than we can preserve and maintain it. Over the last 2 years, we have received new sources of revenue that are going to help us, but by no means solve our maintenance gap. This includes the Fixing Our Streets program and the Build Portland program, and also the state legislature's transportation package of Keep Oregon Moving. Taking all these new funding sources together, we still face a maintenance backlog of $2.2 billion over the next 10 years. Understanding that, we are trying to use these funds as efficiently as possible. We absolutely want to get our biggest bang for the buck, so we're focusing on projects that provide a triple win. One, they have to address a maintenance problem, they have to improve street safety, and they have to help us meet our multimodal goals by improving biking, walking, and transit. So Build Portland is where we've had the most success in identifying triple wins. An example is the Lentz Town Center project, which will improve the bike facilities and implement the Lentz Town Center Business District Transportation Plan with new traffic signals, pedestrian amenities, wider sidewalks, pedestrian crossings, and street lighting. The project on Outer Stark will construct new sidewalks and crossing improvements and provide bicycle facilities from 108th to 162nd, making one of Portland's deadliest streets safer and more attractive. The general fund capital set-aside is another important source of funding for us. In the coming fiscal year, we will use these funds for traffic signal reconstructions and upgrades. With the reconstruction funding, we will rebuild and relamp traffic signals across the city, including several locations that require immediate attention. With the upgrade funding, we will leverage funds from developers that they are required to invest in signal improvements associated with their projects. We're going to build on those investments to upgrade an entire intersection and improve traffic flow, safety, and development potential all at once. In this way, PBOT is responding to failing signal assets in a very strategic and cost-effective manner. I would like to take the opportunity to point out two things about the general fund set-aside program. First, the CBO did not recommend funding for ADA curb ramp improvements. The justification for not funding our request was noting that we had not spent last year's general fund appropriation for curb ramps. As you know, we just negotiated the settlement with CREEK. As part of that negotiation, CREEK demanded to be a part of deciding which ramps got built first. The consent decree was just signed in the last week, and now we're moving ahead with expenditures. An RFP has already been issued, design is underway, and construction will start in July. With another appropriation this year, we could further enhance our response and fulfill the terms of coming, meeting our settlement more quickly. Yes.
So could you just explain that? So on the previous page, you've got $10.5 million under Build to Portland. So why are those two not interchangeable?
So the $10 million that is in the Build Portland is restoring the $2 million of ULF funds that were taken out to fund Build Portland. So on an ongoing basis, that money was taken from our budget, and we took it out of curb ramps, and we need to backfill that. So we're using the Build Portland money to backfill what was taken out.
And that's $10 million over 5 years, so that's where the $2 million. Okay, thank you for explaining.
The second element of the general fund set aside to highlight is that the project scoring doesn't favor paving projects and preventative maintenance. We can prevent very costly future rebuilds by investing in preventative maintenance now. Last year, we completed a number of fixing our streets projects, and I know this map is small, but there's a bigger one in the handout that were given to you. This year, we're going to be even busier as a number of major projects break ground. The Fixing Our Streets program allows us to expand the kind of preventative street repair that saves money and makes it easier to move goods and people around the city. And it also funds much-needed safety improvements in neighborhoods across Portland. With the state transportation package, Keep Oregon Moving, we're going to support a number of projects that you can see on this slide. We're also going to use the funds to support our asset management activities that includes deploying new pavement preservation techniques such as slurry seal. And we're also going to use the asset management funds to grade and gravel unimproved streets throughout the city. Protecting Portlanders from traffic violence is one of my highest priorities. Thanks to your advocacy in the state legislature, we will be able to lower the speed limit on all of our residential streets to 20 miles an hour. Judging by the number of the 20 is plenty signs that are popping up all across the city, this change is resonating with Portlanders. We have three Vision Zero related decision packages in this year's budget. First, we're requesting $650,000 to install a safer pedestrian crossing on North Columbia Boulevard near George Middle School. In August of 2016, a student was seriously injured when he was struck by a car near this intersection. Second, in investigating fatalities and serious crashes involving pedestrians, we have learned that low lighting is often a factor. To improve lighting at intersections with a high number of nighttime crashes, we are requesting $750,000. And third, dangerous driving behaviors and impaired driving are two of the major contributors to fatal and serious crashes. To confront this problem, we need to better educate Portlanders about safe driving practices. Our third package requests $500,000 to fund a driver education campaign to be conducted in partnership with the police and fire. The campaign will build on the PSA campaign that we're sent to launch on April 2nd. A key focus of our work has been institutionalizing equity in everything we do. In the last fiscal year, we began implementation of our five-year plan to advance racial equity. We have over 40 action items, and it involves every major work group in the Bureau. Thanks to the dedication of staff, we were able to make progress on more than half of the action items, including making a concerted effort to increase our MWESB utilization rates. I would, though, like to recognize, thanks to the work of the Bureau of Human Resources, they have started to provide